Hello again. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the last day of November, the 30th of November. This hour of the program, we have this huge monster hit out, which is called 2012, the movie. There are a lot of books written about the year 2012. There are books about maybe destruction by flood or a planet's going to crash into the Earth. It's the end of all time. And our guest this hour says that we really need to think about this pretty carefully. The message, he says, has nothing to do with the end of the world. I think if I were a Maya astronomer turning over in my grave, I would probably say, go get your own zero point. Don't mess with ours. And this, we'll be looking at what the Maya has to say about this. The reason that a lot of this took place is because of the Mayan calendar. And we'll be talking about that and why it is, I think, just as interesting is why it is that so many people are captivated by the end of all time and by 2012 particularly. Professor Anthony Avini is our guest. He is Russell Colgate Distinguished University Professor of Astronomy, Anthropology, and Native American Studies at Colgate University in Hamilton, New York. 2012, inspired by the idea that the world will come to an end on December 21st of that year. That's when the ancient Mayan calendar ends. And Avini has written a book about it, The End of Time, The Maya Mystery of 2012. We'll be welcoming phone calls for him. Our number, as always, is 800-486-8655. And the email address, if you'd like to use that, is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Professor Anthony Avini, hello. Thanks so much for being with us.
Good morning, Kathleen.
Good morning to you. Well, it's all over the place. I guess this movie, which I probably won't see, maybe you have, is a huge hit. But it's not just the Mayan calendar. There are lots of other things at work here that some people want to grab onto and say, hey, we better live now. It's all ending on December 21st, 2012.
Well, probably with good reason. Look at the times we're living in. I mean, we are living in hard times, aren't we? And we can start with 9/11 and just go forward. And they're trying to think of what to call the decade of the aughts. And it's not going to be a very good name because of what's going on. And, you know, on top of all of that, there's a general public distrust of institutions and of scientific knowledge. In times like this, as the historian Hillel Schwartz has written a wonderful book about the turns of the centuries, you know, going back to the 18th, 17th, and 16th, and he points out that in those kinds of difficult times, people tend to look outward to far away places and times for answers to problems that I guess I would suppose, in the absence of better evidence, you know, can best be solved within ourselves. So I think that's part of the reason for all of the interest in this.
Tell me, what does the Maya have to say about this? You're an expert in this whole area. Some of 2012 comes from their calendar, is that right?
Well, Kathleen, the calendar turns over in 2012. You could compare that to Y2K. We all remember that.
Yeah.
And Y12, as I call it in my my book, The End of Time, The Maya Mystery of 2012, that coincides with the overturning of the longest cycle in the Maya calendar, which they call the long count. It's a cycle over 5,000 years long. And you can think of it like the way the Maya kept time, only using days. They didn't bother using other units, so they just clicked off a day at a time. Think of it the same way you might think of the odometer on your car. You know, when it turns 100,000, it's headed for the junkyard. Well, when the Maya calendar turns over and all the numbers go back to zero, for them, that signals not the end of time at all, which I think is a major mistake that people make here who pull this idea out of Maya culture. It really means the start of a new cycle, the way we might start new years or a new decade or a new century.
So why is it that we look at this apocalyptic version of it instead of, oh, it's a whole new world, it's a whole new age, it's going to be wonderful?
Well, in the last chapter of my book, it's entitled Only in America, although only maybe is a slight exaggeration. I attribute a lot of the belief in apocalyptic ideas, contemporary belief in apocalyptic ideas, not just to this whole idea of the end of the world and catastrophe coming out of 9-1-1 and other things, but to our basic religious upbringing. Now, I speak here as a nation. I mean, we were founded by people who were largely religious dissidents, you know, pilgrims and Puritans and such, who came to the New World long after Columbus, but not in search of spices or gold, but rather in search of freedom of religion. These people tended to be more fringy, fringe-like members of the Christian sects, Christian Protestants largely, settled in New England, and then, of course, migrated westward, where I think the creme de la creme of the extremists settled in our area up here in the Northeast, and even in your area, because this is where you have the foundation of all of the early American religious cults, which were very apocalyptically oriented. One can think of the Millerites, who would become the Seventh-day Adventists, predicted the end of the world in 1843. So this whole idea about apocalypse comes from, it comes from Revelation and the book of Daniel. And if you go back and read those Old and New Testament texts, they talk about a rapture and, an apocalyptic ending and a second coming. And there are numerous movies out, that not just 2012, but other movies through time, which suggest that these secrets, to this whole apocalypse and when it will occur, are buried in various ancient texts.
Hmm. And so the Seventh-day Adventists, Seventh-day Adventists, are they also looking at 2012, December 21st, do all of these cults, as you call them, look at the same time period?
Now, largely no, but I gave the Millerites, who were originally a group that became, at least part of that group would become Seventh-day Adventist. I'm speaking here really largely about the Christian, or the part of the Christian religion that interprets the Bible in a literal way.
Right.
And there are many ways to interpret these texts, and I'm certainly not going to say you can't interpret them that way, but I think the answer lies in, at least in America, in people who make a literal interpretation of these texts. Now, to be sure, there are other cultures in the world that have ends of time, or at least ends of cycle, cyclic time, being accompanied by, or it's at least initiated by, catastrophe or disaster. And if you want to know about a flood myth, for example, just ask the people who lived in the Ninth Ward of New Orleans before the terrible Hurricane Katrina came.
Mm-hmm.
We experienced these holocausts, these terrible disasters of earthquakes and floods, and we mythologized them. We make myths and stories about them to remember the power of nature. So I think that the combination of these various kinds of ideas gives rise to this popular notion of the ending of time. But the Maya certainly did not believe time was going to end. It was a new beginning, as do some 2012ers. They propose, instead of a blow up, what you might call a bliss out, the dawning
out
of a new age.
A bliss out. I like that. Have you seen the film 2012?
Oh, Kathleen, I certainly have, and I agree with the reviewers. It's a 1.5-star movie. I mean, I love the effects. I mean, I think the effects were fabulous. I don't know. I wasn't so interested in the characters. They were kind of waxy, tacky characters. But and they didn't say much about the Maya, so I don't have any complaints. I enjoy the movies, and I think if this movie will attract people to become interested in what the Maya really had to say, why, that's great.
But that's not likely, is it?
Well, I don't know. I talked to a friend recently, and I asked him, well, how did you begin becoming an archaeologist? He's a pretty well-known archaeologist. And he said, well, I read Eric von Däniken's book about the chariots of the gods, which suggested that alien cosmonauts had come to Earth and populated the Earth, and that our whole culture is really descended from them. He said, then I got interested in archaeology. So maybe out there'll be one or two young kids who like the video effects, and will get interested in the Maya.
And so when a new era begins for the Maya, when the calendar starts again, what do they hope for? What do they see is associated with that? Anything,
well,
or is it just another
Kathleen,
day?
Kathleen, the best way to answer your question is to ask ourselves in our culture, what happens and what do we think will happen the day after New Year's Eve,
right,
to take a holiday? What do we do at the end of a cycle? Well, we party. I mean, we certainly party. You just go to Mardi Gras in New Orleans, and you'll see what happens prior to midnight on that day. And of course, right at midnight, right at the stroke of 12, the New Orleans police close everything down, and they clean the streets. And then the next day, the good Roman Catholic will have the ash on the forehead. Well, I think most of us in the secular world will make New Year's resolutions. And I think the end of a cycle, whether it be the end of the year or the decade, or even indeed Sunday night before the start of the work week, we all talk about how we're going to go on that diet. You know, we're all on that diet after Thanksgiving, and we're going to make our lives better. We're going to make resolutions. So I think these cyclic overturnings are really about these rituals that we conduct to try to renew ourselves the same way we renew, we find time being renewed by the overturning of that cycle.
I think that you said this, too, and I'm wondering why we're this way, that we are in the habit, not all of us, but we are in the habit of reading things literally in this country. Many of us are. Why is that? It makes us kind of gullible, doesn't it?
Well, I think it can, and heaven knows the number 666, you know, the number of the beast, is a famous number that's been interpreted and reinterpreted. I think that I have to say that part of it comes from people perhaps becoming impatient with trying to drag themselves through the fruits of labor of scientists, you know, which I think very often are not explained well. Many, many popular books and articles written by scientists aren't well written. I said in my article in Archaeology Magazine this year, about 2012, that I think this is a teaching moment that we have. We don't do enough to educate the public. We don't do enough to try to make our ideas understandable in the English language. You know, we use too much scientific jargon and mathematics, and people turn away from that. They become suspicious of it, and then they're inclined to think, well, how can any of that gibberish be true? There's no way I can understand it. So I think we don't do our job very well as teachers and educators, and we should. Well, I know there are many teachers out there who ought to be paid a lot more money for what they do, but I think that we should make an effort, all of us who teach, to try to educate a wider segment of the public, because the ideas that the Maya developed and the calendar and their religion are fascinating, but it's unfortunately we have to drag people through all the jargon.
Yeah. Talk a little bit more about the culture. It was a spectacular culture.
Well, it was, and I think that's why we romanced them. We romanced the Maya, and I think that's really what we're doing. Because they're so much like us. They had a system of writing. They had a very accurate calendar. They had over 1,000 different forms of words, syllables, you might say, in their alphabet. I wouldn't call it an alphabet. It's a syllabary. They developed great astronomical achievements. For example, they were able to track the motion of the planet Venus to an accuracy of one day in 500 years. Now, we just look at a fact like that, and it's quite true because it's in one of their Maya books, one of the codices, this table of the movement of Venus, and we're inclined to say to ourselves, well, how could they do that if they didn't have telescopes or computers?
Mm-hmm.
They must have possessed lost knowledge that they had from computers or some advanced kind of technology. But in fact, the way the Maya did it, and I've had my own students do it, is by watching where Venus is every day with the naked eye. And if you watch where it is every day over a long period, repeatedly, why, you can predict it to that accuracy, provided you've got some pretty good mathematics, which they did. They used the base 20 system, counting on the fingers and toes, you know, ones, 20s, 400s, instead of ones, 10s, 100s. So studying them, I think, in a way, is like holding up a mirror to our own culture. We see different writing, different math, different concepts.
Yeah. But as you said, which I think is a good thing to say, if I were a Maya astronomer turning over in my grave, I would say, go get your own 0 point. Don't mess with ours.
Well, well, Kathleen, the reason why I said that, put it in context, was that the Maya certainly did have a message in their all of the predictions that they made about time. But I don't think the message is intended for us. And said, what's curious to me is that we reach out far into the past and far into space to try to get answers to problems that I think lie within our solutions lie within ourselves. The aliens are not so different from the Maya. I mean, people will say of the aliens that, well, maybe they'll come here to help us. Maybe we'll have immortal life and so on. And but I just find it interesting that we look for answers farther and farther away from ourselves as time progresses. This is a really interesting kind of spiritual deficiency, I think, that we have, or maybe a lack of trust in our own abilities.
Pinpoint the time for me, because I can remember, actually, I hate to admit it, but I think it was probably back in the 60s or 70s I was doing, it seems to me, a lot of shows on UFOs, because there were sightings in Wisconsin, and there were people who really thought that they had...
Well, you got it right. The Age of Aquarius, Kathleen.
Was that when it was?
I hope you're not old enough to remember that, but I sure am. The Age of Aquarius was the idea that the world was going to shift its axis, the same way some people say it will in the year 2012, when the sun passes into the constellation of Aquarius on the first day of spring. And why that helped the fifth dimension get a big hit in that area, the Age of Aquarius. Here's the coming of the Age of Aquarius.
I was just thinking of that song when you were talking.
But this reaching out to the paranormal is a very interesting phenomenon that happens during periods of hard times. And if you look back at the 60s, you did have, well, there was the burning of the cities. There were the revolutions going on campus, the famous Chicago Convention, the Vietnam War. I think it's interesting that this tendency to reach far away for answers, to almost say to yourself, this can't be real, there must be some other reality out there, is very much characteristic, I think, of these periods when you have hard times.
Yeah, but you got to admit, don't you, that it would be nice if we had these group of highly intelligent, very kind and sophisticated people from another planet or whatever they are to show us a new way. I wish that would happen.
Well, I do too. I think we could benefit very much from such an encounter.
Right.
But of course, I think in the end, at least, I don't want to say of course, because many people don't subscribe to my way of acquiring knowledge, which is based on scientific evidence, you know, evidence that you can look at and then analyze in a very rigorous manner. You know, when I look into the evidence, I don't see it. I think the possibilities that there's alien life are limitless, given the number of planets you have and given the fact that the chemistry and physics of the universe is the same everywhere. But, I mean, if we're talking about aliens, then you have to raise the question, but would aliens be like us? Well, you can study biological evolution, and there isn't even a one in billions that such an alien would even have a face and hands, much less a brain that desires to have contact with other brains, or a civilizing kind of intellectual attitude about reaching out and going to other places. There's no evidence for that. So we just don't know. And I have to admit, as a scientist, I certainly don't want to appear as a smug individual know-it-all. I will say that there's many, many realms of knowledge we don't know about. We have to keep an open mind about that.
We're going to welcome phone calls. I'm sure we'll have many on this. Professor Anthony Avini is our guest. Russell Colgate, Distinguished University Professor of Astronomy, Anthropology, and Native American Studies at Colgate University. He is the author of, well, he's written many things, but most pertinent to our conversation, The End of Time, The Maya Mystery of 2012. He teaches at Colgate in two departments, physics, astronomy, and sociology and anthropology. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email address, talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to phone calls now, starting with Tony from Juneau. Hi, Tony.
Hi there.
Hi.
Got to get you off speakerphone.
Okay.
First, I wanted to say that I was going to call this just anticipating that this was going to be another guy promoting this theory, and I can't stand these theories that you hear about just routinely. So I will be complimenting you, rather. Secondly, I want to say my daughter, she came home from school. She's 15 and asked about it because she'd been hearing everybody talk about this at school. And so I took her to the Internet and Googled the apocalypse and end of time. And we just found you couldn't believe the graph over the last 500 years and then 100 years it had. There was just, it seemed like many apocalyptic theories every year. I just think that this just happens to be promoted a lot more than other ones. And I also wanted to say I'm glad you made the point about religion and the revelation, because I think that a lot of it does stem from that theory and our book of Revelation, and I don't like that either. That's my point.
Let me ask you, Tony, was your daughter talking about this because of the movie that's out or some other reason?
Oh, no. This was actually more than a month ago. It was before I had even heard, I think, or maybe 2 months ago, I think, before we even heard about the movie. So there was already many kids, she said, that were talking about it, and she wanted to know my take on it.
Huh.
Well, Tony, thank you for choosing a very, very good name for yourself. Say that first. Did you know there were 13 predictions that the world would come to an end in 2006 alone? So you're quite right. Every time I Google up, Maya Apocalypse 2012 or whatever it is, I get more and more hits. It's in response to a couple of interesting things you mentioned. There are, of course, a lot of people in it for the action. There's no question that, like the two people who recently invaded the White House party, you know, there are people who want, who like the notoriety, and they, and I guess they like the money that can be made from writing a quick book. My role as a teacher is to teach my students to question and to be skeptical, at least to start out being skeptical and not swallow everything that's put in front of them. Heaven knows they don't do it with food. I think they should take that same attitude with ideas. And I will say that people do have a tendency not to question and to pretty much believe what they read or what somebody tells them. So my job as a teacher is to try to promote the idea of questioning things and researching them and seeing, you know, if some of the alignments or things that come together might not just be a coincidence. And that's a much harder thing to do than to just find yourself in awe by romancing the Maya.
There must have been a lot of this going around, maybe not in referring to the Maya, but in the year 2000, you mentioned Y2K, there must have been other, were there on the Internet, I don't keep track of this usually, to say that the world is ending?
Well, they certainly were, and we have to remember that the modern age of fear didn't really start with 9/11. There were plenty of fears around from nuclear holocaust and other things that existed before that. You may remember one of the biggest fears was that the entire computing system of the world, all of the cyber world was going to crash on that eve, and of course not much happened. But we're really into it now, and I really think it's with the 9/11 that we turned the corner. I think what we're experiencing here is an expanded extension of the phenomenon of the year 2000.
Yes. Thank you so much, Tony, for your call. Rich from Einlander. Hello, Rich.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi, Rich.
Happy after Thanksgiving.
You as well.
I have a question for your guest. This all seems much easier than really thinking about what it will mean for the world if China and India become as industrialized as the United States of America. And there have been good books written about anti-intellectualism in our country. Al Gore wrote The Assault on Reason, and then Susan Jacoby, I think her name was, about the age of American unreason. And night after night on TV, we can see people having fun with the idea that Americans are ignorant, like Jay Leno is jaywalking and asking questions. And people say they're teachers and they don't know basic facts. People can't name the three branches of government or come up with the name of a single Supreme Court justice. And I just think Neil Postman, an educator, had it nailed way back when he said we're amusing ourselves to death. We're watching what are called reality TV shows, and they're not. They're so staged with so many cameras around. And I'm grateful for your guest, but I just think the links here are to be drawn to something in American culture that basically says we're supposed to be told the truth rather than to reach it by study.
Well, Rich, those are excellent comments, and I agree with you. There certainly are bigger issues that go down here. I'm a fan, a great fan of Jacoby, and I really like her book. I tried to explain as we were going along that I have difficulty, I guess I'll say, trying to teach my students to develop the attitude of questioning, a general skeptical attitude. So that's why I think so much of what we're talking about with this attitude of American, uninformed, and proud of it, you know, it's almost that we're proud to be uninformed, and as you say, we can make fun of the educated eggheads. The problem lies in education, you know, and everybody in my day has always talked about being the education president. But the minute and there's any crunch in the budget, education is one of the first things to be cut. And I do think that the answer, not the answer, but one way out of this problem of thinking that we have to have everything explained to us is to maybe do a little bit better with our education system. Now, I know there's a lot wrong with it, but I think that I've really seen it decline over the years, and I think it's lamentable.
Thank you, Rich, so much. Love to have you call always. Ray from Milwaukee, hello.
Good morning. I want to talk about solar cycles and the unusual pattern we've been in, I guess, for the last 40 years. The sun has been extremely energetic, especially 2004 and 2005. We saw some of the largest flares ever recorded. And those flares just happened not to be pointed directly at Earth. But one of those flares moved at, I don't know if it was 10 or 20 times the speed of a normal flare. And particles from the sun reached the Earth within 8 hours, which meant these particles, protons, were moving at a significant fraction of the speed of light, like a quarter of the speed of light. Scientists still to this day can't explain that flare, and that was during the solar minimum years of 2004-2005. And Hurricane Katrina bracketed the 1 week that scientists were completely blown away by the sun's activity, supposed to be during the minimum. That week of Katrina saw giant flares, both the beginning of the week and I guess at the end of the week. And now we're coming into what's supposed to be the solar maximum in 2012. And it just maybe it's a coincidence. This is when all this is tied together. But if we see some flares like what we saw during the last minimum happen during the maximum, and now we're all interconnected through these satellites, if we saw the world satellite systems go down, you would see water being turned off, power being turned off, all kinds of strange anomalies since the entire world is now connected through these satellite systems.
All right, let's get an answer because our guest is an astronomer in addition to a number of other titles. Professor Avini?
Well, Ray, there are several interesting questions there about the sun. And I think we always have to remember when we look up at that yellow shining disk in the sky that we live in very close proximity to a seething nuclear fire, 93 million miles away, but that's not far if the sun decides to hiccup. Now, what we know of the sun and its evolutionary course is that it is quite stable, although there is this 22-year cycle, if you deal with the magnetic part of it, of activity, where you go through peaks and maxima and minima. The solar physicists who monitor the sun tell me that 2012 will be a maximum, but not, as Lawrence Joseph suggests in his book, an extraordinary one. It will be quite an ordinary maximum, nothing unusual. Now, as to the flares that occurred at minimum, I have to point out here that that we have only had the techno capacity to detect details about the sun and its activity in the recent past. And so, like most things technological, we look harder. I mean, I think we've got more medical tests now than we did a long, long time ago. And it's questionable whether, you know, just exactly what the payoff from all those detailed techno improvements have been. So we have to note here that we don't detect things with the accuracy. Well, we do detect things with greater accuracy now than we do then. As to coincidences, you know, yes, Katrina and a solar flare happened close to each other. So did a total eclipse of the sun and the death of Princess Diana. And here's where I think you have to take a long, hard look, with all respect, Ray, at statistics. You have to look at how many hurricanes, how many earthquakes, what intensity, how many solar flares, and so on. And when you look at the problem from a larger scale point of view, there really is no correlation. So I don't think anything unusual is going to happen in this cycle any more than the last one or the one before. But again, I'll always have to resort to my honest opinion that you never know what can happen.
Right. Tell me more, because you mentioned him in your writings about this. Who is this guy, Lawrence Joseph, who says that what's going to happen with the sun will block out a black hole, radiation is going to stream at us, et cetera, the planets are going to realign? What's that all about?
Well, who he is, I think, is certainly not anybody who is engaged in research in any of these topics. His book is one of the scariest, called Apocalypse 2012. He claims that his editor, book editor, insisted on that title. But he gets my nomination, if you want, and the Academy Award for being the scariest of all the scary people. I mean, he predicts just about anything that can happen will happen. First of all, about the alignment, let me make this clear, because John Major Jenkins has capitalized on this. It is true that the sun on the day of the December solstice will align with the center of the galaxy. Now, having said that, the accuracy within which you can say that it's aligned on that day is one day in 300 years. The sun is close to the galactic center at that time of year, but it's been close for 100 years ago, and it'll be close 100 years from now. Also, why choose the December solstice? Why don't you pick the June solstice or the equinox? I think it's another example, as I just suggested in the case of the Katrina flare relation, of cherry-picking data and putting two things together. To be honest, I don't buy it. I'm at a loss to understand how the sun passing in front of the galaxy is going to get in front of a black hole, which is then going to cause solar flares. There's no physics that I understand, and I can't claim to understand all of it, that suggests that anything like that's going to happen. So, and furthermore, I should add, the Maya didn't give one hoot about aligning anything with anything, including the center of the galaxy.
Right. What did they think about the Milky Way?
The Milky Way was, for them, the road of the dead. It was the road that people took to go to Shebal Ba, which is the afterworld where they passed their next existence. It's not a tree. Jenkins claims that it's a tree, a cosmic tree, and that the axis of the tree aligns on Creation Day. And I don't subscribe to it. I only base my opinion on what people say who have studied the Maya texts in some detail. And I have to add, when it comes to the paranormal knowledge, I just think that the way that people acquire knowledge here is very different, and I think that the scientific way of acquiring knowledge by using, based on evidence and reason, is irreconcilable with some of these gleanings that come through revelation. I mean, I respect revelation, certainly when it comes to religion, but there's no way I can prove or disprove that anybody did or didn't see God. So I think we're talking here about irreconcilable access to knowledge, different kinds of knowledge.
Yeah. Thanks, Ray, for your call. Frank from Madison. Hi, Frank.
Hello.
Hi.
Another fine guest. And Kathleen, you partially asked him my question, but I'll try not to repeat too much. I was really curious for the year 2001, but in most people's imagination, the year 2000, that there wasn't more millennial thinking and panic, especially for those of us who are dependent upon the Gregorian calendar. And I wanted to ask if perhaps the 2000, the two Y2K phenomenon filled that imaginative space, but it didn't seem to be such a panic except amongst techies. Perhaps we're looking at some sort of transference from those ideas to the Mayan 2012, and that's because we're not quite so based upon the birth of Christ as we once were, New Age thinking. And there's also this tension about climate change, and whenever I, not whenever, but often, if I mention this in casual conversation, that we need to be adapting to what is going to become a crisis, 2012 comes up, you know, as if we don't have to worry about that because in 2012 things are going to change. So thank you very much.
Thanks, Frank.
Well, Frank from Madison, which is a great town, your last comment is really interesting. I hadn't thought about that the idea of maybe avoiding even thinking about climate change makes sense if you think the world's going to come to an end in 3 years.
Sure, right.
That's brilliant. On your first comment about people not getting that excited, I don't know if Y12, as I call it, is a delayed Y2K phenomenon. I think it probably is. But I'm kind of thinking, as you were talking, that maybe there's some reason for optimism. I'm hearing a lot of really intelligent people talk to me today, which is always a delight to talk to people who seem informed about things and maybe seem a little skeptical themselves. Maybe there's reason for optimism that in this age we're finally beginning to realize that that it doesn't make too much sense to be so fatalistic, and maybe that there's more than we can do that we can do ourselves to try to solve our problems. So I'm enriched by Frank's phone call.
I always am, too. But, Tony, you might be dealing with a very special audience. You know,
that's my suspicion.
I think so, too. That's why it was such a pleasure to do this show. Thank you, Frank, for the call. We go to Dick from Waukesha next. Hi, Dick.
Hi, Kathleen and guest. I wonder about why the Maya is a little more to my question. How about the Aztec and the Inca and other strains or cultures in the continents, and for that matter, for other parts of the world, and kind of related to the previous caller's question about the climate, or suggestion about climate change, location in the various land bodies, cold ones and warm ones, and in between.
Yeah, well, I mean, if I'm understanding the nature of your comment, I think it's really interesting, the Americas, as I would call them, you know, North and South America, particularly interesting to me because of the range of environments in which these cultures developed. I mean, the Maya, when I take my students to Maya land, they are fascinated at the idea that these people could build cities in a what to them looks like an impenetrable jungle. Turns out to be a very rich place in terms of species, you know, harboring more than half of all the animal and plant species, you know, in Mesoamerica. And then you look at the Inca by comparison, and they're living in practically a vertical environment, running from the high Andes at 15,000 feet down to the coast. And they had to go through a lot of machinations to make their eco world perform for them. I mean, they even had a calendar that was used to give the times to plant potatoes in various elevations because of the way the climate varies. I think we can learn a lot from these cultures and their environments about perhaps how to protect our own environments. And one of the parts that I'm most fascinated with it has to do with the city of Copan, one of the great Maya cities, which collapsed because they overfarmed the land. And we would do well to study some of these lessons of history. I don't know if they're going to solve the problem of global warming for us, but they will at least teach us some lessons about how to survive.
Thank you so much for your call, Dick. We need to pause for a moment and we'll return. Our number is 800-486-8655. Our guest is Professor Anthony Avini, Russell Holgate Distinguished University Professor of Astronomy Anthropology and Native American Studies at Colgate University. We're talking about 2012, and, you know, there are a lot of books that look at the idea that the world will come to an end on December 21st of that year. Part of this goes back to looking way backward. Sometimes we look outward when things are bad for us. Our guest says that's when the ancient Mayan calendar ends, but it's a new beginning. It's a new calendar for the Mayans. So why are we looking at this as the apocalypse, the end of the world, the time that the sun is going to align with the center of the galaxy on that day and maybe black out the black hole, radiation streaming at us, you know, the end of things. We're looking at all of the books and the movies and the websites associated with this and trying to figure out what is it within us that allows many of us to gobble it up. Two more phone calls in a moment. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Returning to your phone calls now, let's go to Scott from Wisconsin Dells. Hi, Scott.
Hi there, Kathleen.
Hi.
Before I ask my question, I would like to just raise a quick Y2K issue, and that is that, you know, people talk about Y2K as if it was all hype and there was really not an issue. But I, as somebody who is in that tech field and actually was working a help desk on that night, and as somebody who's not a programmer, I would like to say that the reason that that wasn't an issue was that a whole lot of programmers did a whole lot of hard work to rectify a real problem, and they did a good job, and we got through it. And I, as somebody would have taken those calls, I'm one grateful guy. Now, my question is that I think I heard the professor say that the Mayans just did day-by-day observations and didn't break down their time frames any more than individual days. And I just was curious about that because it seems to me the only time increment that I know of that's really artificial is the week. But, you know, days and months and years are pretty much events based on natural observation. So if these folks were watching the sky on that kind of a basis, did they not in fact have like a month increment that they had figured out and year? And if so, what kind of numbers did they attach to those?
Good question, Scott. And sorry if I implied they used only the day. The day was the basic unit of currency. Interestingly enough, they did not break down time to units less than a day. They did not recognize minutes, seconds, and so on. It's probably because they didn't need to keep time that accurately. But they certainly did build up days into months, months of units of 20 days, and they did build months up into years. They had a 365-day year, 18 months of 20 days each, with 5 days left over at the end, just like the Egyptians, you know, five days of bad luck, which I find kind of curious. And then the years were built up into units that would then multiply by 20, and what we call the tunes, and the tunes of the years, then the katuns and the baktuns. So we can think of the Maya cyclic system as being built up out of small numbers into bigger and bigger ones based on 20. The main number that they used was a 260-day cycle, which is 13 times 20, 13 being the number of layers of Maya heaven, and 20, of course, the count of the fingers and toes. 260 is interesting because it's also close to the gestation period of the human female, and it's also a cycle of Venus and an eclipse cycle. So the Maya were really looking for that mother of all numbers, if you will, that brought together the human body and the cosmos. I loved your opening comment about how the computer programmers worked hard, and I think it's a great lesson in this Y-12 business that, yes, maybe we really can solve our own problems. You didn't depend on aliens. You guys did the work yourselves. So good point.
Thank you, Scott, so much for your call. As always, Kathy from Finland, Minnesota. Hi.
Hi, I'm so excited. I can't believe I'm on the air. In my readings about 2012, scientists have talked about a pole reversal that's going on right now, and something to do with the axis and the tilt of the Earth is changing, which is going to affect the magnetics. you know, in our environment and even in our brains. And I just wanted you to ask your guest to comment on that.
Sure, Kathy. I do talk about all of these issues, including the flares and everything in my book. And I talk about the pole reversal. It is, you're talking here about the magnetic poles of the Earth, which are responsible for trapping charged particles from the sun that produce those beautiful northern lights that some of us northerners get to see, and also radio fade out and a few other things. There are communication problems that we can get into when the solar cycle is strong, the 11-year cycle that Ray referred to in his call earlier. The poles are showing signs of undergoing a reversal, and that means that the north and south magnetic poles are migrating at an accelerated rate, and there will eventually, sometime in the next 1,000 years or so, meteorologists predict, sometime in the next 1,000 years or so, will undergo a reversal. That won't be an instant flip-flop like whipping around a magnet 180 degrees, but it will occur. As the poles drift, the magnetic poles will be weaker. In fact, there will probably be a period where we'll have small multiple poles or mini poles. So we can expect to have some communication problems during this reversal. But again, I have to point to the fact that it is not a sudden event that will happen on one day. It will happen over a long period of time, and we certainly will be affected by it, as we are by the flares.
Yeah. Thanks, Kathy. Manolo from Milwaukee is next. Hi. Hello. I got to turn that radio down so we can hear you. I find your areas of expertise so interesting. Can you tell me, Tony, how you happen to be? I think you've been described as a Mesoamerican archaeoastronomer.
Yeah, well, that's too long to belabor. I'm a Kathleen to be. To put it bluntly, I have my degrees in physics and astronomy, my PhD in astronomy. And when I came to Colgate many years ago, I worked on the stars and star formation. And then I got conned by my students into taking a trip to Mexico to go look at the pyramids. And I got hooked. So I ended up being a transplant. I'm kind of a hybrid. My education, if you will, in ancient astronomy and Maya astronomy has come only later. So wonderful that we live in a place where we can change careers. So I kind of do both, but my heart really lies with the Maya.
Yeah. Oh, that's interesting. And it was a result of going there.
Yeah. Huh. Yeah. It was just on a whimsical trip that Colgate University had a January term at the time, and we used to go off the field and take students with us and do projects. And I got interested in the alignments of the pyramids in Teotihuacan, and we did a little research. Nobody had ever really measured them or studied them, so we started a little program, and that's where archaeoastronomy was born. You can call it, digging for the stars, if you want. You look down as well as up, and it really is all about how ancient people in the world practiced astronomy.
Let's go back to phone calls. We go to Nick next from Green Bay. Hi, Nick.
Hi, I just heard the comment about the magnetic pole shifting.
Okay.
And I know it's great right now because the flares are great for my amateur radio, but what's that going to do to my amateur radio?
I don't think I got all. I think you want to know what it does to the radio, do you, Nick?
The amateur radio, yes.
Oh, the amateur radio, yeah.
Right.
Well, when you have the transparency in the ionosphere change, that is to say, explain very briefly, that when these particles come in greater intensity, they tend to change the constitution of the atmosphere slightly, the upper atmosphere, which then promotes the passage of radio waves out of the Earth's atmosphere. So in other words, they don't get bounced as well back to Earth. So that means we don't communicate as well if most of the energy goes out instead of getting bounced back. Think of it as maybe a mirror with a lot of cracks in it. You don't get a very good image. So that's the answer for your Green Bay fan.
We go to Manolo now. I hope he's with us. Hi, Manolo.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my phone call. And I have a comment and two quick questions. The comment is that I thought that the 2012 theory that it was the end, I thought it wasn't true. Like most people were thinking like, oh, it's the end. But now that I'm listening to the show, then it confirmed that I said, no, it could not be the end. That's my comment, and you already went over that. And
well,
then two very quick questions. The first one is, I've been in Teotihuacan myself. I live very close to there. And the Sun Pyramid is smaller or bigger than the Giza Pyramid in Egypt. Do you happen to know, Professor?
Yes, I do, Manolo. The Sun Pyramid is the same width as the Great Pyramid of Giza, but it's only about two-thirds as high, so that the volume of the Great Pyramid of Giza is greater than the Pyramid of the Sun of Teotihuacan.
Hmm. Okay, and the second question is that most of us from Mexico, we see the calendar as the Aztec calendar. Are two different calendars this? The Aztec calendar, what we most typically tend to know, or is it the same as the Maya calendar?
That's a good question. The Aztec and the Maya are not the same people. I mean, there's a lot of people think that they are. They're not the same culture. The calendar is basically the same. It has the same kinds of units. The Maya calendar had more of them, and the one thing that the Maya calendar had that the Aztec didn't is the long count. They were the ones that had the huge cycle that they kept detailed track of. So there are some differences, but they are really arguably from a similar culture, the same way you might say Romanians and French are the same. You know, they're both Western civilization.
Thank you very much for being with us. It was such an interesting hour.
Delight to be with your very fine audience.
Yeah, thanks. They're good. Thank you. Professor Anthony Avini, Russell Colgate, Distinguished University Professor of Astronomy, Anthropology, and Native American Studies at Colgate University. He is the author of The End of Time, The Maya Mystery of 2012. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour and to Rhonda as well for on-air production. A reminder, we're on Facebook, so we can talk to each other. Go to WPR.org, Kathleen Dunn, find that little thing there, and then you'll see our page and sign up. Until tomorrow.